It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today's talk is on Bodhidharma's first precept, no killing life. And I'd like to start with this terrible story of the Catholic Church killing the souls of mothers who gave birth illegitimately. Well, they weren't married, unmarried, unwed girls, and they would take the babies and sell them at a great profit and kill the souls of these girls. It's very painful. It's a true story. But this is the conventional view of no killing life. And then in the second half, we'll do Bodhidharma's ultimate truth view of no killing life. So this story is written by an Irish short story writer. Her name is Claire Keegan. And it's called Small Things Like These. And I'm gonna tell you the story and read from her some explanations of what I tell you, so you get a feeling also for her writing. But the hero, Bill Furlong, is the father of five young girls and owner of a coal business. And he and his wife, Eileen, have worked very hard to keep their family together through bitter cold winters and financially strained circumstances. And so Claire Keegan tells us, this is about Bill Furlong. His mother, at the age of 16, had fallen pregnant while working as a domestic for Mrs. Wilson, the Protestant widow who lived in the big house a few miles outside of town. When his mother's trouble became known and her people made it clear that they'd have no more to do with her, Mrs. Wilson, instead of giving his mother her walking papers, told her she should stay on and keep her work. On the morning Furlong was born, it was Mrs. Wilson who had his mother taken into the hospital and had them brought home. It was the 1st of April. The story begins at Christmas time with Bill's five girls writing their letters to Santa Claus. And Eileen, we notice, never stops cleaning, cooking, sewing, managing, and it's clear that Bill feels lonely for her, but he can't find a way in. And one night, he delivers coal to the convent, which also runs a conjoining building, St. Margaret's, the only good school for girls in town. So Claire Keegan says, the weather had turned dry and colder, and people remarked on what a picture the convent made, how like a Christmas card it almost was, with the yews and evergreens dusted in frost, and how the birds, for some reason, had not touched a single berry on the holly bushes there. The old gardener himself had said so. The good shepherd nuns in charge of the convent ran a training school there for girls, providing them with a basic education. They also ran a laundry business. Some said that the training school girls, as they were known, weren't students of anything, but girls of low character who spent their days being reformed by doing penance, by washing the stains out of the dirty linen that they worked from dawn till night doing. The local nurse had told that she'd been out to treat a 15-year-old with varicose veins from standing so long at the washtubs. Others swore the place was no better than a mother and baby home where common unmarried girls went in to be hidden away after they had given birth, saying it was their own people who had put them in there and after their illegitimates had been adopted out to rich Americans or sent off to Australia, that the nuns got good money by placing these babies out foreign, that it was an industry they had going. So that was what Claire Keegan, how she describes this. So now in the barn where Bill unloads the coal, he finds the girls living there like animals, starving and exhausted, and begging him to let them out so they could drown themselves in the river, which would be better than what they're doing now. But he can do nothing. And later he goes again and brings Sarah, one of the girls, into the Mother Superior, who in his presence, while he's there, she lavishes food and care on her and passes him a 50-pound note. So everyone is aware of the scam, but as they say, the Mother Superior has her finger in every pie. So speaking up is virtual death. It's like the mafia. So finally, on Christmas Eve, Bill goes back to the barn where he had first seen Sarah and brings her home. Claire Keegan describes this. As they carried on along and met more people Furlong did and did not know, he found himself asking, was there any point in being alive without helping one another? Was it possible to carry on along through all the years, the decades, through an entire life without once being brave enough to go against what was there and yet call yourself a Christian and face yourself in the mirror? How light and tall he almost felt walking along with this girl at his side and some fresh, new, unrecognizable joy in his heart. Was it possible that the best bit of him was shining forth and surfacing? Some part of him, whatever it could be called, was there any name for it? Was going wild? He knew that his heart was going wild. The fact was that he would pay for it from Eileen, but never once in his whole and unremarkable life had he known a happiness akin to this. Not even when his infant girls were first placed in his arms and he had heard their healthy, obstinate cries. He thought of Mrs. Wilson, of her daily kindness, of how she had corrected and encouraged him, of the small things she had said and done and had refused to do and say, and what she must have known, the things which, when added up, amounted to a life. Had it not been for her, his mother might very well have wound up in that place. In an earlier time, it could have been his own mother he was saving, if saving was what this could be called. And only God knew what would have happened to him, where he might have ended up. The worst was yet to come, he knew. Already he could feel a world of trouble waiting for him behind the next door. But the worst that could have happened was also already behind him, the thing not done, which could have been, which he would have had to live with for the rest of his life. Whatever suffering he was now to meet was a long way from what the girl at his side had already endured and might yet surpass. Climbing the street toward his own front door with the barefooted girl and the box of shoes, his fear more than outweighed every other feeling. But in his foolish heart, because he was born on April Fool's Day, he not only hoped, but legitimately believed that they would manage. So that's what the story ends there. Claire Keegan doesn't tell us what happened when Eileen came on the scene. So she leaves it for us to just imagine what happened. And this story is about killing life, killing the heart of life. We see life being killed emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, and physically. And everybody knows about it and takes the hush money the Mother Superior provides and says nothing. This part of the story is true. Apparently, it had been going on all over Ireland for years, maybe 100 years. And when it was finally exposed, it killed the Catholic Church for many Irish people. So in the end, it killed the Catholic Church for many Irish people, understandably. Boy, it was very hard to read that story, I have to say. Moving on, much of what I'm going to present about the 10 grave precepts is from a book called Embracing Mind. Passages from a Teisho are talks given by Koben Chino Otogawa during the 5 7-day sessions a year that he held for his Palo Alto students. Koben was brought over from Eheji by Suzuki Roshi and practiced with me at Tassajara, married my friend Harriet, had 2 boys and a girl, and died by jumping into a lake where his young daughter had wandered and drowned, trying in vain to save her. The death of a bodhisattva that he certainly was. Koben's practice as a teacher was as unusual as he was. While he attended, this is a little history about him, because it's pretty unusual, actually. He attended Kamazawa University, the best school for Buddhist studies in Japan, and then got a master's degree at yet another renowned Buddhist university, where his monastic training was at Eheji, the best Soto Zen monastery, and his job after graduating, so to speak, was being hired by Eheji to train their monks in forms and ceremonies, at which he excelled. And somewhere in this mix, he studied Zazen with Kodo Sawaki. Remember Kodo Sawaki? He was the grandfather of Okumura Roshi. And he's the one who had no temple because he just walked all over Japan and taught Zazen wherever he was asked. And he became very famous and he got lots of invitations. And somehow Koben studied with him. So as a Zen teacher in his own right, he emphasized Zazen, reminiscent of Kodo Sawaki's style, his intensive Zazen style. You remember he did once a month, a 5-day session of 14 hours of sitting a day, 14. And that's all. 14 hours a day of sitting for 5 days. And that's what Kodo Sawaki provided for his students. And now Koben, alongside that style, in the spirit of that style, has 5 7-day sessions a year for his students. But the spirit of Koben's sessions was different from Kodo Sawaki's. In Koben's session, many of his students, including himself, were parents. And there was a rule that if anybody at any time heard that they were required to be at home for their children for some reason, they could just simply leave and then come back whenever they finished. And they needed no permission. They needed nothing. They just were respected as adults and they did what they needed to do and they sat the sitting as best they could. And it had a very adult and autonomous atmosphere. So that's extremely unusual. And I think quite wonderful that Coben provided that for his students. And so in his talks, which I'll read to you, he speaks very slowly because he doesn't have a script. He just speaks from his heart on whatever subject he's speaking on. And you can feel him waiting for his words to arise and discovering his words, which remain very fresh. And then his students then use the tapes from the, that were, his lectures were taped, even though they weren't pre-written. And the students transcribed the tapes and created this book, Embracing Mind, that I found just wonderful. And it's, since he did, he wasn't a writer, so that's the only book we have of him. But I mention it so that if you're interested, you can get it, I think, on Amazon. All right. So the first Bodhidharma precept is no killing life. And I've already told you, I'm sure, but you've forgotten, that the first sentence of every one of Bodhidharma's precepts, these 10, we're going to do 10, is self-nature is mysteriously profound. Self-nature is mysteriously profound. In the midst of eternal Dharma, not to give rise to the view of stopping and extinction is called no killing life precept. I'll read that again. Self-nature is mysteriously profound. In the midst of eternal Dharma, not to give rise to the view of stopping and extinction is called no killing life precept. So in the midst of eternal Dharma, Dharma is reality. And here it's expressed as ultimate truth. So ultimate truth, even though we don't understand it because we're not awakened, we still, on faith, take from the great masters who have provided us with this in the lineage, that this is how things actually are. So following conventional truths, it seems entirely natural to think with fear of ourselves and our loved ones dying. But that would be giving rise to the view of stopping and extinction, which is killing life, because Dharma is eternal. So Coben says, when you say life, the word, there are various lives you may see, but if you were looking at your own life, you feel what it is, but you can't explain. You have to describe various events and what happened. So many times we say I or my or mine. There's something going on which makes it possible to say so. So when I pay attention to this I, it is always the true self in all attempts to express something. Even misspeech points to the truth. Even very confused talk points to what is to be spoken. It's just the expression which wasn't clear, because the reality of I was many elements existing in confusion. So this is the first part of Coben's talk, and I'm thinking that this, what I just read to you, this part about the I, we can't say in words exactly what it is. We can say, well, we did this and that, but it never quite gets it. And I think that this This is Coben's effort to explain the first sentence, self-nature is mysteriously profound. Bodhidharma's first words in all 10 grave precepts, self-nature is mysteriously profound. So then Coben continues, imagine a very tough, strong, vigorous cowboy holding a gun in a showdown. The other cowboy misses his shot, and this cowboy now has another chance to control everything, but he is waiting to shoot. We can see he can kill. What is going on in his mind? If he gets into a philosophical discussion with himself, he has lost his chance. If he throws away the gun, you see what is in his mind. He cannot kill. That is our true nature. And yet, for survival, we have to take many lives, and we always get into this dilemma. Eating vegetables or fish is basically the same dilemma. What is it that is living? Precepts exist to cause a dilemma for us and a deeper understanding of what this giving, taking life is. So then I'm going to interfere a second. The dilemma is no killing life is our true nature. Yet we cannot exist even one day without killing life. That's the dilemma. And Coben is saying the precepts are for causing dilemmas for us because we need to study these, what's going on. You know, that the actual truth is no killing life, that there is no life to kill, actually. And there's no us who can kill. Remember, there's no individual independent self. We're all interconnected. So how can we cut off a part of this interconnected self? And yet, how can we not and still survive? That's the dilemma. Coben goes on, over 100,000 million years of sustaining our life, each of our lives, we naturally have had to take the lives of others. It is a daily thing we do to sustain our life and continue to live. For all of us, the first precept, no killing life, is a kind of impossible precept to keep. It was first spoken a long time ago, about 26 centuries ago, and people living together vowed to keep this precept. Now it is the 20th century, and we are still living our life in a very primitive way. We are facing the great danger of the decay of all lives on earth, not only humankind. If we take this precept literally, the only way to keep it is to die without food. It sets forth a contradiction. Even if we don't directly participate in killing lives, if somebody else takes a life so we can survive, it's the same thing. So precepts are not just about your ethical conduct. They have something to do with yours and others' basic nature. Bodhidharma taught, when you did not give rise to the idea of birth and extinction, this is called no killing life. In truth of eternity, and then he uses the Japanese words, joju ho. Joju is eternal dwelling, and ho is truth. This precept is about giving birth to no birth, no extinction. So no birth, no death, which is the ultimate truth. Coben continues. Dogen Zenji expresses this precept, do not kill. Do not let other people kill. And beyond that, flourish our Buddha seeds. He, Dogen, covers the ethics of our life and the deeper meaning. What is this life all about? We eat living food. Through our food, we learn constantly how to live on this earth. We are constantly supported by all phenomenal currents of life. We are living by all beings. That is the truth. We are lived by whom and whatever we take, by their teachings that guide us. And this, now this is going to turn everything around. Listen carefully. One way to live, this is Coben, one way to live is to show all of their natures through our existence. It is different from our usual way of continuously exploring our capacities for what we really want to do. So do you understand? He's saying that instead of focusing on the fact that we eat food, we might consider how our lives fulfill the life of anything we eat. The fulfillment of the life of every carrot I ate last night is this Dharma talk that I'm giving right now. So those carrots got inside me and turned into the engine for my giving this Dharma talk. So you can say, I'm the servant of the carrot. You could say that. I'm the servant of the carrot. Endlessly, we do things because of the wishes and desires that arise within us. Is this the only way to live? 100,000 million lives came into our life, which is each of these dynamic lives, and we are fulfilling their wish of who they wanted to be. That is the way to live the precepts. We listen to all existences, how every being wanted to be, not only what we ate, what we took, but all existences. Continuous existence is in each moment of our life. Whether you are being aware of your deeds or not, it is happening in that way. It is like eating a meal. Our body is big and the food is little. So we say, I took this life. But when you compare the amount of food you took and the amount of energy of your life, they are actually the same. This is a very interesting way of one moment of the universe. All beings offer their life for it and return to nothing. All beings return to nothing, offering their lives and making one moment possible. This is how we humans live, how vegetables live and die. The farmer's job is to take care of the vegetables, maybe to sprinkle the water. Maybe the vegetables will say, I'm sorry, I'm eating you. Maybe only humans say, I killed this lettuce. So practice and life become the same thing. The question of how you are going to live is answered by expressing, not just understanding what life is all about. And finally, he says, Shikantaza is one immediate answer to the question of what life is all about. And getting up from Shikantaza is the continuous answer to how to live your life. How you live is how everything lives. For this reason, one period of sitting is not something we do as an exercise to reach some kind of enlightened state. We all know this world is the radiant dynamic of the enlightened world, enlightened functioning. There is no need to seek after enlightenment. The functioning of each sense organ is part of the experiencing of enlightenment. Every second, many, many elements of enlightenment are happening. Life was born as awakened existence. Remember, when Shakyamuni Buddha attained enlightenment, he awakened with this earth and with all beings. So this teaching is so profound. 100,000 million lives came into our life, which is each of these dynamic lives, and we are fulfilling their wish of who they wanted to be. This is the way to live the precepts. That idea that we, by eating, fulfill their wish of who they wanted to be, reversing everything we normally think. Do you remember the third truth? So there's the ultimate truth. So the third truth is the middle way. And we've talked about this before, but I'm going to say it again. There's the ultimate truth, which is actually the truth, which we, since we're unawakened, we can't understand that. And then there's the conventional truth by which we live. And then there's the middle way, which is the conventional truth by which we live through the lens of the ultimate truth. So we need to rely on conventional truths for how to behave. All the while, we recognize that conventional truth doesn't exist. That's what Buddhism offers us. It offers us this other lens about our behavior and our existence, that we follow conventional truth, but through the lens of ultimate truth, we understand that it doesn't exist, that we don't actually exist as we think we exist. Dogen says, life is not killed. It means, so this is important. Life is not killed. So life and not killed are the same. It means not killing is not something you do. It's just the way things are. Life is not killed. Life is no killing life. And your practice is just the way things are. This is Dogen. If you examine life thoroughly, you will see that it is entirely interconnected. You cannot cut off an interconnected thing. So there is no killing life. So he says, life is not killed. Not killed and life are the same thing. Since we are interconnected and we cannot cut off an interconnected thing, killing is impossible. Not to kill is just the way things are. In John Muir's words, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. I think that's very lovely. And John Dido Lurie Roshi says, Buddha nature never dies. The realm of Buddha nature is completely beyond dualism. As a result, you cannot oppose killing and non-killing against each other. There is no killing. There is no not being killed. And there's no one to kill. To give rise to the thought to kill instantly violates the precepts from this perspective. He says, the thought itself is essentially deluded. So we have many thoughts that are deluded, according to John Dido Lurie. Tenshin Roshi Reb says, the precept is not talking about killing and not killing. This precept is pointing out that either of those ways of looking at things is violating Buddha's mind. If you think of killing, you're violating Buddha's mind, or not killing, you're violating Buddha's mind. Thinking you can kill is violating this precept. Thinking you can keep this precept in a conventional sense is also violating this precept. If you were afraid of being killed, it is because you think that you can kill someone. People who believe that they can kill need some way to stop themselves from acting on their belief. That's why we have these precepts. Tenshin Roshi also says, life is just living and then it's gone. it changes. And if death happens, that's it. There's just death. Don't expect any other result. This precept, Reb stresses, is asking us to give up before and after mind and enter a different reality. It's saying that if you would die to before and after and enter the actual present moment, you could bring a light back to the world and teach people what it means not to kill. He means, I think, that it is in the that life is in the Dharma position. Life is in the Dharma position of life with its own before and after, and death is in the Dharma position of death with its own before and after. In not doing killing, not doing is the important point. If you're not doing killing, killing ceases to exist. Finally, he says, in order to practice this precept, you've got to expect no other result than just not to kill. Not to kill is just not to kill. Not to kill is one precept. Not to kill is 10 precepts. Not to kill is the entire world. There's nothing else. There's no application. That's the precept. And his main point, finally, in this regard, please remember, this precept is not talking about how to apply the precept. This precept is pointing to how to become a Buddha. So I'm going to go over some of the important points. The most important was the last one, Reb's words. Please remember, this precept is not talking about how to apply the precept. This precept is pointing out how to become a Buddha. And secondly, John Dido Lurie's point, Buddha nature never dies. Buddha nature is an ultimate truth. So he's saying Buddha nature never dies. The realm of Buddha nature is completely beyond dualism. As a result, you cannot oppose killing. You cannot oppose killing and not killing against each other. There is no killing. There is no being killed, and there is no one to kill. To give rise to the thought to kill instantly violates the precepts from this perspective. The thought itself is essentially deluded. And the third important point, since we are interconnected, we cannot cut off an interconnected thing. Killing is impossible. Not to kill is just the way things are. Not to kill is just the way things are. The fourth important point, when you compare the amount of food you took and the amount of energy of your life, they are actually the same. This is a very interesting way to keep one moment of the universe. All beings offer their life for it and return to nothing. All beings return to nothing, offering their lives and making one moment possible. This is how we humans live, how vegetables live and die. And fifth, precepts exist to cause a dilemma for us and a deeper understanding of what this giving, taking life is. And sixth and last, so many times we say I or me or mine, there is something going on which makes it possible to say so when I pay attention to this I, it is always the true self in all attempts to express something. And here are some ideas for your reflection during the week. First, if you'd had lived in Ireland during the 100 years and knew all about the laundry, but you also knew that if you said anything, your livelihood would be crushed, your wife and family would be without subsistence, and everyone would blame you for bringing this child of low character home to add to their troubles. What would you have done? It's a little bit of like if you had lived in Germany during the Holocaust, what would you have done? And second, consider what Coben says. All beings return to nothing, offering their lives and making one moment possible. This is how we human lives and how vegetables live and die. He's basically proposing that we are sacrificing our lives to the vegetable. And for a vegetable, how we humans eat, how we humans eat you lives out their life. And it's if you're the vegetable, that's how your life is actualized. And usually we think the opposite. And I'm wondering, which view do you align with? To think about that, which view do you align with? They're very different. And then thirdly, Coben says to his students, so many times we say I or my or mine, and there's something going on which makes it possible to say so. So when I pay attention to this I, it is always the true self in all attempts to express something. So basically he's saying that every single moment in all of your behaviors, regardless of how inept, we're always trying to express our true self. And so the question for reflection is, do you agree? So when you spill a glass of milk and the shards are all over the kitchen floor, are you trying to express your true self? That's the question. Think about that. Fourth, Buddha Dharma taught, when you do not give rise to the idea of birth and extinction, this is called no killing life. So this means that even the thought of killing, even having an idea of birth and death, is a serious misunderstanding. Since this is an ultimate truth and we're not able to grasp it with our minds, I wonder if you can grasp it with your body. And so I'm suggesting that you sit with this idea during Zazen and just hold it gently and see what happens. You don't have to try to think about it, but just hold the thought while you're doing Zazen. And the fifth one is this third truth, the truth of the middle way, which is not the conventional truth and not the ultimate truth, but the conventional truth through the lens of the ultimate truth. Can you give an example? That's the fifth question for reflection during this week. Can you give an example of the middle way? I wonder if you have questions.
So, Gail, here we have like a comment, and the comment is, I love Coben's idea that it is our life that is sacrificed for the carrot, not the carrot for us. I never thought about it in this way, yet it makes so much sense.
I know. I'm remembering when I first heard this idea. I was visiting Harriet, my friend, his wife. I was visiting them in their home in Palo Alto, and we were talking. Of course, I knew Coben from Tassajara, and I knew Harriet from Tassajara. And he just casually came out with this idea. And I was just like stunned, like, oh my God, because it did make so much sense. It's like, of course, of course. I'm at the service of whatever, you know, I think, you know, big me is eating this little food, but it's this, I'm actually the servant of this little food. And the ultimate purpose of the little food's life is what I do. And so then I felt a huge sense of responsibility, like, what I choose to do, so many other beings' lives are fulfilled through that. I better be careful. I remember that's what I felt that day. It's really a profound idea. And it's also a little, I mean, this was Coben's idea, but it's a very Dogen-like idea. Dogen always does this. He'll take something and he'll say it, and then he turns it completely around the other way. And that's sort of what Coben has done here. It's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So one question that we got is, how does knowing about ultimate truths change our understanding of conventional truths?
There's a lot of ways, and I'm glad you asked, because ultimate truths are hard, and so why bother? And the reason why bother is, first of all, once we know the ultimate truth, even if we don't understand it, it changes. We also know that what we've always thought of the way we actually exist is not so. So we can't be all that smug anymore in our lives. What we think we're doing and who we think we are. Once we know about ultimate truths, we can't sit the same with that. And then once we know about ultimate truths, some of us are inspired to do the practices that those who do understand ultimate truths did in order to awaken to that understanding. And it seems that Zazen was the practice that our whole lineage did to awaken to this understanding. And so that's one reason why we practice Zazen. Also, at least for me, when I learned about ultimate truths, I started to be way more careful about how I did things and how I thought about things. And I felt more not to be so sure all the time, not to be so sure. Also, there's an urge to simplify your life so that things are clearer. When there, you have fewer things and less clutter, you can see your life more clearly. And part of, so that gives you the potential to see beyond what's right in front of you. I'm just starting, but I know somebody else could go on for half an hour about this subject, but it's a beginning. I'm sorry, I can't do more than that right now, but thank you for asking.
Thank you, Gail. Another question that we just got is, why was it said that the Catholic Church killed souls as opposed to lives?
Killed souls as opposed to lives?
Yes.
That why I just made up that kill souls, because reading the story, it didn't say exactly. So the part that when he came, when he was delivering coal and nobody was there, so he went to the barn and put the coal in the barn, and that's when he saw. That's the first time he saw all these kind of young girls, almost like animals, starving and exhausted and just almost crawling after him to let them out so they can drown themselves in the river. They had no soul left. They were just, if you would just let us out and drown in the river, we would be so thankful. So I use the word, that was my word, not hers, that the Catholic Church just killed those souls. It didn't say in the short story what actually happened later to those girls. You can just use your imagination. They probably just died there. I mean, they weren't let out, and they weren't fed enough to live. So it was just a scam that went on, and no one had the courage to do anything. It's over now, and maybe she's telling the story of how it got to be over. Finally, someone did something. So the answer to your question is the souls was my word, not hers. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another one. Okay, so we got like a follow-up comment. Oh, I see. I assumed that people's lives were killed and I was confused. Thank you for clarifying.
Okay, good. I mean, in the end, they probably were. They took their babies and sold them for good money. And then, so that's the laundry. The laundry was, that's how I'm interpreting it, this. The laundry was cleaning out their souls. So they didn't have any desire to live anymore anyway. The idea that this was the Catholic Church, this is, what were the Good Shepherd nuns? Oh my God, it's just awful. It's just awful. Anyway, the story was beautifully written, so I do recommend it anyway. Thank you.
So another question that we have, self-nature is mysteriously profound. This feels like a very high-level observation. Why is it mentioned in the context of the precepts?
It's mentioned in the concept of the precepts because the precepts are both, the precepts contain in themselves both ultimate truth and conventional truth. So the last series, I think it was the fourth series that we studied the precepts, we studied these 10 great precepts before. And in that series, we only talked about the conventional truth level. So, and the reason was, is that that's an important level. That's how we behave. We have to be thinking about these precepts in our behavior. But the precepts are also, they're larger than that. The precepts contain both conventional and ultimate truth. And we don't hear about the ultimate truth side. And even I didn't hear about the ultimate truth side until I read Bodhidharma's precepts, the way he talks about them. He's only talking about the ultimate truth side. So it's a very interesting way of enlarging our idea of the precepts to include the way Bodhidharma presents them. Because even though they're not presented that way by others, still the precepts themselves contain both levels of understanding. They're very profound. Taking the precepts is a huge commitment. And like we said before, the vows are even more serious than the marriage vows. So they aren't just, I vow to do this or that behavior. They're, I vow to understand the nature of reality, actually. I think I'm out of time, and I want to encourage you to look at that question and answer section, which have very interesting questions and answers that we've gone over, but it's neat to see them again and reflect on them. I think you'll enjoy it when you have nothing else to do. And I definitely want to be thanking my team, Brendan and Sahar and Brian. And I want to thank you all for being here and listening and making these talks possible. And also the people who listen during the week. Thank you so much. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.